Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for this holiday Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm your host, Magnus Tewald. We have a good show for you today, a special presentation on one of the hidden parts of university life. What happens when students come into conflict with the university or with their professors or other power centers at the university? It's not something that most students, fortunately, have to deal with, but when they do, it can often be a terrible situation due to the really great power imbalances between students and faculty or students and the university itself. It can take a lot of forms, from academic problems such as cheating and plagiarism, but also involves a lot of other issues as well, such as conflicts with professors, disputes over marks, questions over whether courses or credits are going to be recognized or whether students have met the qualifications, and is not as clear-cut as you might think. When students find themselves in this situation, it can really be difficult due to the power imbalances. This can especially be true for graduate students, for whom everything they're doing at university can be really dependent on one or two professors or supervisors. And the situations can take a lot of different forms, from academic issues to personal issues to harassment issues. Dealing with these is really difficult. And because of that, both the Undergraduate Student Society and the Graduate Student Societies at SFU have staff dedicated to supporting students with these conflicts. It's a difficult issue. I talked to Trish Everett, student advocate for the Simon Fraser Student Society, and Harjab Gruel, who's the advocacy director for the Graduate Student Society at SFU, about this issue. It's a really interesting conversation, and I hope you'll enjoy it. All right, welcome. With me today is Trish Everett, student advocacy coordinator with the Simon Fraser Student Society, and Harjab Gruel, advocate and policy advisor with the Graduate Student Society here at SFU. Maybe just very briefly, you can introduce yourselves and tell me a bit about your role helping students. Start with you, Trish.
Okay, thanks, Magnus. My name is Trish, pronouns are she, her, hers, and I work for the SFSS. My office is on the third floor of the Student Union building, and students can come to me when they are dealing with challenges at the university. So if they are accused of academic integrity violations, or if they're having trouble with a professor, or, you know, all sorts of things, and I can help them figure out a path forward and sometimes push the university on their behalf.
Great. And Harjab?
Yeah, so very similar. I kind of have a dual role at the society. I work for the Grad Student Society. We're a little bit of a smaller society, so we have less staff, but there's a lot of dual roles. But I also work as an advocate, similar to what Trish was saying, any issues that students might be facing, academic related. We do like non-academic issues as well. Have dabbled into a little bit of off-campus stuff as well, just if a graduate student needs support or advice on something, not necessarily taking on something off-campus, but directing them to resources or advising them on best practices in terms of how to approach an issue. It's a confidential office. We meet with individual students, groups of students, bring forward issues that they might be having with their department, their supervisors, the school as a whole. All the work that goes behind actually getting some outcomes, right? which is the vast majority of the work sometimes.
Right. Okay, well, let's start with this. Why are positions like yours needed? Doesn't the university have the best interests of student at heart?
I think we both laughed on that one. In a perfect world, yes, the university would have students' interests at heart at all times. But we know that this is an imperfect world, and universities can't serve everyone's needs all the time, always. And so that's where roles like ours come in, to help with those edge cases, those fringe scenarios, students who need accommodations or academic concessions, finding ways to make the university work for as many students as possible, I think is really the core of my mandate.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And very similarly, I mean, both structurally, but also just, you know, philosophically, don't believe that change happens from within. You need sort of people that can think independent of institutional logic, think independent of institutional, like, financial or legal priorities, or whatever may be the case, for them to not take action, to change policy, to support a student, to do right by a student in any case. Every staff member can be beholden to that. We have some really great, you know, faculty members and staff at SFU that really go the extra mile to support students. So I'm not saying that I'm not homogenizing individuals within the university, but as a system, and if you kind of look at it structurally as a system, the system still prevents these things from happening, right? And that's why the outside voices, like, you know, I'm sure Trish feels similarly, like, we know there's controversial issues happening at the university now.
Yeah.
And I've never felt any reluctance to be just frank and open about the opinions of, like, grad students or society on those issues, because we're completely independent, right? And that, I think, is extremely important. And the relationship in terms of the vast sort of power differential there is between the administration and faculty and where students sit within that power structure.
Right. And for listeners who may not be aware of somehow how things at the university are organized, both your organizations are independent organizations run by and for students.
Yeah.
And so your responsibility is just the students, and you're not sort of caught up in a, you know, you don't have any, other than maintaining a good relationship, you don't have an institutional responsibility to the university.
Exactly. And we're not necessarily beholden to the same rules that a lot of staff and faculty of the university are, because the university isn't our employer.
Mm-hmm. So what, you mentioned it a little bit, but what sort of issues do students come to you with?
For me, it's run a wide range, and I've been in the role now just shy of 2 years. It's the first student advocate the SFSS has had in quite some time. So some of my first cases were around trying to figure out where a new mom could feed her baby on campus. And we discovered that there really wasn't anywhere aside from the Women's Center in the Student Union building on the Burnaby campus where a student could nurse a child or pump or generally chest feed. So that's been a project we've been working on now about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And as of this morning, I have a report that it's on the way. So that's been really nice news. But most of my cases are things like accusations of cheating, plagiarism. There's a lot of that. And taking those cases to the University Board of Student Discipline for appeal. I think one thing a lot of students might not know is that for most major decisions that will impact them at the university, there is almost always an appeal mechanism if you disagree with the decision that's been made about you. And so finding what that mechanism is and how to navigate that has been a really big part of my work.
Right.
Yeah. And I think, like, this is where maybe our roles, like, shift a little bit, like, in terms of difference. Like, again, the nature of grad studies, like, there's just less courses that graduate students are taking. And generally, like, I think some of the appeals and that stuff, there's a few around the professional programs that we deal with, but there's not nearly as many that I think that happen at the undergrad level. But a lot of our, like, I say the vast majority of issues that I face are usually between supervisors and students. So, like, you know, someone doing research, having conflict or issues with their supervisor, and a whole range of issues comes up from that, right? Everything from, you know, progress reports to IP issues to thesis defenses, and then the kind of, like, social kind of justice issues of, you know, experiencing sexism, racism, various things within the program.
Yeah, for grad students, you know, the relationship is quite different than it is for undergrads, because for grad, you know, I think most people understand the sort of basic student instructor relationship, but at the grad student level, it's student instructor, student employer,
mentor.
Often a pretty tight social setting too, because there's, you know, grad students and professors and other department or staff represent a pretty small, often a quite small group, and that must bring up a lot of different issues.
I mean, a lot of different issues and a lot of quite egregious behavior. You know, like just some of the things that I've seen, it sometimes is a little bit shocking that I see, you know, think that, oh, faculty members can do this and believe they can get away with it. But, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, especially around sexual violence and like sort of gender-based like advocacy, where people, like, not just at universities, but generally talk about how isolation is so key to the manipulation and abuse of power, right? The more isolated you are, whether it's a family setting or whatever the case may be, an abuser will oftentimes try to cut off support and make you more isolated in order to exercise their power. And I would argue being a graduate student at a university is one of the most isolating experiences people have in their lives, because exactly what you said, you have a single supervisor that's in charge of your immigration paperwork for your work, your study permit, your thesis, your references for when you graduate, your academic progress. They're employing you. We've even had some egregious cases where, like, they're even renting property to their graduate students. Like, so there's like a huge power imbalance that happens in those cases. And it ends up being that, you know, again, going back to the earlier point about the independence from the university, the confidentiality with which students are comfortable approaching my office because of the very real fear of retaliation if they speak up, is one of the, like, it's hugely important at the university, because there is a real genuine fear, not just because of the structure, but also because of like lived experience of retaliation that's actually occurring at the university.
Right. So just, there's also another position here on campus, the ombudsperson's position, which that one, I think it actually used to be part of the, started with the student society, but now it's a university office. How does that relate to your positions and your roles?
Yeah, I think the office is co-funded by the SFSS, GSS, and the university. For me, the key difference is that the ombuds role is neutral.
Right.
Their job is to balance the interests of students and the university, faculty and the university, and to be neutral in all of those interactions. That's not my view of my role. My job is to be on the side of students and to have their backs. And most of the time, that's very straightforward and easy to do. And sometimes that looks like telling a student, you know, you may have made a mistake here and this is how that goes. But for me, ultimately, transparency with the institution is really important, and having someone that you can rely on that will have no impact on your academic progress to give you advice, I think, is really helpful.
Speaking of the power difference, you know, I've been doing some reading around this issue, and a book I've read is Complaint by Sarah Ahmed. I'm sure you're both familiar with it. One of the things she talks about is how often just starting in the process of making a complaint or making an appeal has its own repercussions. And I've talked to some students around this issue who've brought forth a complaint, and not even necessarily about something that's, you know, a super touchy subject like something relating to a personal interaction, but, you know, just something about how they've been, whether they've been allowed to do something or not do something. And once they brought that forward, they really felt a real shift in temperature, you know, their experience in within their department. What do students need to know, and when should they be coming to talk to people like yourselves when they're feeling there's an issue? Because I imagine a lot of students probably try and initially navigate things on their own. And certainly, again, when I've talked to students around this issue, that's often where things have started, and it gets to be a point where they perhaps even feel lost in the process. It's like, oh my God, this isn't the way I thought it was going to be, and I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And then they're reaching out. So when if a student feels they have an issue, when should they be coming to your offices?
I mean, my take is usually earlier the better, particularly because some of these issues, you know, like stuff like grade appeals and stuff are just like they happen when the issue arises, right? There's a grade that you're unsatisfied with or an exam issue. But for most of the other stuff, and I think you'd probably agree, the earlier that you see a problem developing, mm-hmm. even before you think about speaking out, it's better to kind of touch base with us. Because, again, to your point, I think it's navigating the policy framework of the university, which is one huge step that people, aren't comfortable taking because it is complicated and you don't know where to go and who should be responding to certain things. And I also think it's really important because, like, our roles can set expectations, both in terms of like the limits, but also where we believe we can push a policy because we don't think the policy is adequate, right? Like, because we've seen the flaws of policy, right? Yeah. Like, we've gone through various cases and seen, okay, well, a student isn't getting an adequate outcome through the use of this policy. Let's say it's bullying and harassment or human rights policy or something else. And we can speak a bit more about it, like, if you want. I don't want to kind of derail this question, but like, that's, again, goes to the power structure, right? In terms mm-hmm. of like how students are positioned, even with our roles, there's a very different position we have vis-a-vis a staff member and their union and the university, right? And so there's a lot of limits on the outcomes that students can attain.
Yeah.
That it's better for you to know those limits, both to try to address them or have your expectations changed, right? Like, I think it's really, really helpful in that sense.
Is that something you can expand on? Like, what are those kind of limits that people need to be aware of?
I mean, some of the hardest walls I've run up against so far, tuition refunds, that's usually a pretty hard wall. There is a process, and sometimes they do come through in unusual circumstances, but that one's pretty hard and fast. Hard blocks, when a student has a hard block on their registration.
What's a hard block?
Yeah, it's when they haven't met an expectation for their program by a certain point. Mm-hmm. A hard block will be put on their ability to register for subsequent courses. I usually see that with students who need to take FAL or FAN, which are the sort of fundamentals in language and numbers classes. Yeah. I have never gotten those to move, so and I've pushed.
Right.
So there's certain things where a student's energy might be better placed finding a workaround or some other pathway to get themselves out of the situation they're in. And that's where I think being creative and being agile as an advocate becomes very helpful, because there's usually more than one pathway, but...
And we can go a little bit outside policy, right? Again, because we're not the ombudsperson. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to understand the policy, but we don't have to kind of treat it as gospel either, right? Like, we can try to get outcomes even if the policy doesn't allow it. But on the tuition piece, it's just, I was smiling as you were saying that because, you know, one of the biggest barriers structurally is that there's a legal liability approach mm-hmm. that the university takes to all issues, which really inhibits the ability for students to get like a fair, transparent process in order to deal with their stuff. So one of the things that, I mean, I had guessed this was the case, but I've been hearing more and more that this is likely why this happens. One of the reasons why the university doesn't give tuition refunds is because it's an admission of some kind of guilt, right? Like, if a professor, like, we had a situation where a professor was teaching a class during the pandemic where they just provided the students with slides for the course and said, I'm available for 1 hour a week to answer questions, but that was the instruction that we're going to get for the entire course. And mind you, this is in a professional program, very expensive professional grad level program, right? And obviously everyone saw this. Anyone that was made aware of this knew that this was kind of egregious and very problematic. But rather than refunding the tuition to the students, they gave them scholarships. because a scholarship isn't an admission of guilt,
yeah.
right? And so you see this, like, in terms of some of the limits of, like, what students can expect is that we've really struggled for the university to investigate issues. And again, if you think about it, when you're investigating, say, an incident, like a racist incident or something happens in a classroom, well, if you investigate it and you find that racism occurred,
then what?
In their mind, right? I think it's a flawed logic. I'll explain why. But in their mind, that's legal liability because you've acknowledged that racism occurred in the classroom and like there's liability there. And what I've been trying to like suggest to them is that if you knew that it occurred and you ignored it, your liability actually increases.
Yeah.
And they haven't quite come to that conclusion. Other schools have, UBC has, other schools have. But at SFU, I don't think they've quite arrived at those kinds of conclusions. But you can see that, like, that framework, and it's not just academia. This happens in workplaces mm-hmm. everywhere, right? Where, like, lawyers and, like, insurance companies will tell you that you shouldn't investigate things or, like, look or affirm any wrongdoing happening because it is a liability on the whatever institution you're talking about, right? So I feel like that is a huge barrier in the sense that because students aren't a labor union where you could go through a grievance process where you're required to do mm-hmm. a proper at the table grievance and have outcomes and conclusions and like remedies put in place. We don't have that as students, right? Like we can't force the university at the table. So the university can pick and choose what they are and aren't going to investigate, right? And that's been, when I talk about the kind of structural relationship and power, I think that's one of the biggest issues mm-hmm. with students getting fair and proper treatment at the university.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. I mean, I think that's where the pressure that we can put on the right administrators, the right department heads, the right leaders in the university, we can make it pretty unpleasant for them to ignore a problem. Mm-hmm. And I imagine you have more than yeah. I just by virtue of how long you've been around. Yeah. But that pressure piece, that it's an arm's length outside body telling you that this is a problem and you're ignoring it, that's a powerful thing. Mm-hmm. And in my case, I've got about 28,000 undergrads in the SFSS that we could potentially rile up on an issue. And that's right. not insignificant. Mm-hmm. I haven't had to do that yet, thankfully. My relationships across campus are generally quite productive. But I'm very aware that that's in the back pocket.
Right.
I came up through the union movement. I was the president of the Teaching Assistants Union at UBC, so the equivalent to the TSSU. And so that's where I sort of cut my teeth in this kind of work, holding universities accountable to their employees and their students. So I bring a lot of that mentality to this role.
And those points get to the question of, with all these processes and procedures, you know, who do they serve? And, you know, I mean, you know, there's the sort of saying that, you know, in its like different circumstance that, you know, HR is there to protect the company, not the employee. And imagine in many respects, it's the same thing here, that all these processes and procedures and appeal processes are primarily set up or at least function to protect the university, you know, rather than the students, even if, you know, the intent was perhaps more egalitarian when they're created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I would say even like, so one of the, like the sexual violence policies, which are mm-hmm. mandated, and I would say arguably like, you know, like they kind of get legitimately, but also because of the mandate get more attention by universities, right? Yeah. Like they're reviewed and there's a lot of like kind of feedback and there's amazing advocacy that happens around these policies, right? And you know, from engaging and like speaking with people that do this work around like sexual violence and gender-based justice is like, those are still flawed, right? With yeah. all the attention that we've given to them, they're still flawed in terms of like what outcomes are actually provided to students and mm-hmm. how, like, you know, what is like, again, to the point of what is acknowledged and what is investigated and all of these things, right? So I think you're absolutely right. Like you know, people talk about it like the law serves the state, like it's like the policies serve the university, right? Like that's what this is about. And I think people need to understand it that way. And I also do feel like there is a legal and what I would call like a neoliberal pressure on it being this way as well, right? Because if universities were publicly funded more robustly and you weren't relying on tuition and these revenue models and all of these kinds of things to like generate the income that you need for a university, you could have large funds that are set aside for people to like absolve the university of certain wrongdoing and et cetera, happening at the university. And also like you could also shift the kind of faculty and people you're attracting to the university, right? Because like, I think they're like, so SFU got ranked in, I think, the World University Rankings as the most entrepreneurial university. And when I saw that, I was like, I don't know if that's a good thing. Exactly. I'm like, that actually worries me a little bit. And then you see the kind of like backside of all of this, everything from like, you know, like there's the legal argument to not do the tuition refund, but there's also the revenue argument. Mm-hmm. You're literally just falling under this revenue logic, whereas is that like, you have people that believe that the university should operate, even though it's not a for-profit company, the logic of a for-profit company should be applied to the university, and that the increasing revenue of the university is seen as healthy, right? And I'm not saying like any increase is bad, but like this isn't a growth-based model. Like we're not like looking here at like maximizing like market share, right? Like you're trying to provide education and quality education to people. And that's also affordable, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, we forget about the affordability piece, but like proper funding of these universities also would alleviate some of that pressure you're saying right. to have policies that just defend the university, because they're not just defending them legally, they're defending them economically as well, right?
And I think there's almost like a cultural piece to it as well, where the university wants to be seen in a very specific light. And for many students, that might be an accurate representation of their time here. And I'm perpetually reminding myself that I deal with the edge cases and the students who are in difficulty for the most part. So I am not seeing the students that are super happy here. And so I have to remind myself that like right. this is a good place for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a value for the university in appearing to be student focused, appearing to be student centric. And they deliver on that in a lot of ways, but there are other ways where they can certainly do a lot better. And those are the pieces where I think having someone with an outside perspective pushing and not letting go becomes really quite important.
Is there a better way that these processes could be organized or set up or institutionalized that would make them a little more independent of the university? Like would it be, because as it sets up now, I mean, the university creates the policies and then the university enforces the policies and then the university decides on how those policies are dealt with and what happens to the students who are caught up in them. So students have very little power except, you know, for perhaps what is, you know, what they can put into it and what you can help them with. Is there a way that this could be, you know, made more independent? Harjip, you mentioned that some institutions have created some policies that have done a better role. But we've seen in a lot of places where there's eventually been a need to separate these kind of, I don't know, processes from the institutions that they're running, because it just inevitably, you know, it's hard for them to be truly balanced and yeah. independent.
I think for me, I would love to see the investigative bodies have a much higher degree of independence. I think the way that the Ombuds Office is sort of funded by all three parties is a good example of that. And I think Laura Reed does excellent work, and we work together on occasion. But I think the Office of Student Supports Rights and Responsibilities needs about four times the amount of support that it actually has. And if offices like that, like bullying and harassment, like the SVSPO, had a higher degree of independence from the legal arm of the university, from the business arm of the university, I think that would absolutely improve things for everyone. It would make a more transparent process. it would make a process that stakeholders could actually believe in and feel good about participating in. Mm-hmm. For me, that's the big one.
100%. Like, you know, even the UBC example I was bringing up, it is exactly that. Like, again, I don't want to uphold UBC because I'm sure there's flaws there as well. I'm not saying it's perfect.
There are.
But like, yeah,
alumna. Yeah.
But the thing that they try to create, like, I think exactly what Trish is saying, like some level of independence for the investigative arm of the university from, like, both administration and faculty, I think is hugely important. You know, like we, like, you know, like a quick simple example, right? Like we have the vice provost research and international office, and we have a research misconduct like policy, which that office would investigate under, right? And simple questions about conflict of interest, which again, I'll talk about that for a second in a moment. But when you look at an issue of conflict of interest, right, you have this office that is supposed to investigate research misconduct and wrongdoing, but they also are responsible, and their primary role is to bring in research revenue to the university. So if you have a misconduct complaint against a faculty member that, for example, brings in a lot of money to the university, guess what? You probably are not going to want to initiate an investigation against that faculty member, right? So it's like a basic level, like at a base level, it's a conflict of interest that we have identified to the university. Mm-hmm. They reviewed the policy, but they haven't changed that aspect of it. Yeah. But when we look at that, like, it's actually the conflict of interest policy that is actually not great at this university either, because the entire policy talks about managing conflict of interest as opposed to avoiding it. And to Trish's point, I think it should be avoided the vast majority of time and only managed in cases where it can't be avoided.
Yep.
Right? But they just take a management approach to everything, right? Which has been hugely problematic. And based on all of this, like one small thing in terms of independence, I've just thought about, like, I don't know the feasibility of it because it really depends on the province, like thinking about these things in a more serious way, is that the investigations office for all universities should just be outside of the universities,
mm-hmm.
right? Like similar, like not like the BC Ombuds, because the BC Ombuds can't actually investigate and like intervene on cases. They can only review the outcomes of what has happened. And do recommendations for future cases. But I'm like an actual investigative office that looks at present day complaints and cases would be, I think, hugely valuable.
Yep. And maybe there's a threshold where if a case is of a certain nature or a certain risk or a certain severity, it would be handled by that body. But smaller problems can be handled internally. Mm-hmm. I think financially that would make it more feasible. Yeah. Your point about the ethics in research, mm-hmm. I think, is particularly concerning given that we will be having a medical school at SFU soon, and that is going to include a lot more human subjects research. And so making sure that the university is well prepared to handle that in a way that is ethical and free of conflict of interest, I think, is important to everyone.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about what students need to know when they are finding themselves caught up in this. And I think if you agree, maybe we'll break it up into two sections. Mm-hmm. One kind of like academic stuff, which I imagine sort of happens that people find out they're in trouble when they're told they're in trouble. And then a separate thing, you know, the, I think perhaps more complicated issues around various relationships with supervisors and superiors. So, In the academic questions, when a student gets notified that they're in trouble, they've done something wrong, or alleged to do something wrong, what should they do?
My first instinct would be to email Trish. And I recognize that not all students want to reach out for in-person contact and assistance. So I've made guides and breakdowns of policy that are available on my website through sfss.ca, services, student advocacy, that break down what to do, where to go, how each process works. But if you don't want to go that route, come talk to me. I can walk you through it. But generalized advice would be to keep everything in writing. I think Harjep will probably agree there. that if you are accused of an academic integrity violation, you should be able to meet with your instructor to talk about it before the official report is filed. And that is a hugely important piece of procedural fairness, that you have the right to respond to those allegations before it goes any further. And unfortunately, there's faculty that will skip that step. And a lot of things can just be cleared up in that initial meeting between a student and a faculty member. Once you've had that meeting, if an official report is filed, you have 3 weeks to file an appeal. And if you take anything from this chat, 3 weeks is the deadline for just about everything at SFU if you disagree with the decision that's been made. It's in tiny print behind two links, and I have been pushing to make that information way more obvious and upfront.
That's really fast when
it's fast.
A student's facing what probably for almost all of them is a super stressful experience.
Yep. And it's usually during exam time and you're writing papers and trying to finish and maybe your graduation is on the line. Like, it's never convenient. So that is the big piece. 3 weeks is that magic number. And if you go beyond that 3 weeks, they will almost never consider an appeal. Yeah.
I mean, I don't have much to add to that. Just aside from the fact that, like, I think going again to like Trish's early comment about contact, you know, the advocate right away is also just, you know, sometimes, you know, to the point of like keeping everything in writing, which I echo as well, hugely important. Doing things like timelines, right? Mm. Like in terms of like dates, what happened, when it happened. But also, like, I think in meeting with either of us, you might become aware of things that might be relevant to your case that you would have thought otherwise weren't, right? Information, scenarios, what has happened. And I think just the ability to talk through what has happened with someone is hugely valuable for that reason, right? That you actually figure out like, okay, you know, you just feel initially sometimes like this feels unfair, but because you don't really know policy and precedent and like how the university treats various cases, you might not kind of really be able to articulate why it's unfair. Mm. And that's why I think the value of the offices are really there, is that it really helps in that regard.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about the other kind of more personal relationships type of scenarios that come up, because in that situation, and the reason I wanted to separate it out is because often a student's sense that something's off or not right or maybe unfair is going to arise long before they get to the point of feeling they need to do file a formal complaint or enact some sort of process. And at the same time, I'm sure it's extremely difficult to deal with and sort of understand what they need to be doing. Mm-hmm. How can students navigate that? And what kind of resources, in addition to your offices, are available? Because I imagine talking and advice early on when you think things aren't quite right would be super valuable to those students.
Yeah, I think similarly, for the same reasons, right? Like, you kind of don't know precedent. You don't know what is possible, understanding policy. So for those reasons, again, just echoing, like, meeting with an advocate or someone is useful. The one other thing I would just say is that if you have some trust and good relationships with other, you know, for sure your peers as students, but also potentially with faculty, like, is asking a few kind of, like, not, like, controversial, but just some questions about, hey, like, find out a little bit more. Just because I think in a lot of those cases, you find out, like, whether the person you're having this issue with, these kind of personal, like, whether it's faculty or someone else, like, there might be a pattern of behavior. Mm-hmm. There might be, like, sort of some awareness that people have about the issue. You know, again, right, like, whisper networks used a lot among women or non-male identified folks in the community around, like, sort of sexual predators or sexual violence issues have been more, you know, people always say are more effective than the policies because they actually protect people and build awareness. Similar stuff happens around just kind of like personal levels of like harassment and abuse that might not be sexual violence, but just other forms of it, exploitation or like sort of poor behavior. One of the things that like I've really pushed for in my role after my first year was trying to collectivize sort of knowledge mm-hmm. around like what's going on in departments and with certain faculty members without like necessarily like this approach of being like, oh, we need to like dig up stuff on the person. But just like if there's an awareness and then there's a pattern, we should know. Right. So I think that's the other part of it that I think it's really difficult to do because the university processes really individualize a complaint. Right. Like they really want to just be like, OK, what's the issue? They'll focus it on a narrow policy. They'll focus it on a narrow single student case. They'll preach confidentiality over and over again so you don't talk to anyone. But it should be your right to talk to someone about the experiences that you have. So overcoming that stuff sometimes is a struggle. And again, why meeting with the advocacy office is it kind of helps people do that with confidence because we're not telling you to do anything that's like a violation of university policy. We're just telling you to be do your due diligence to know what's going on in terms of those interactions you might be having, right? So
yeah, I think I would add to that to sort of trust your gut. You'd be surprised how often your gut is telling you what you need to know. Document the concrete facts as well as how your feelings come from those facts, and that can sometimes be different. And if you feel like you can speak to the instructor of the course about whatever the issue is, if that doesn't feel right, perhaps you can talk to a TA. If that doesn't feel right, there's maybe a faculty member somewhere in your department who's been an ally in the past or that you get along with. And I also find that depending on the department, sometimes the academic advisors can be surprisingly helpful for these situations for undergrads. Particularly in navigating sort of departmental personnel weirdness. I think those would be sort of my main points of advice there, and that it's okay to stick up for yourself. Mm-hmm. There absolutely is a power dynamic at play in most classrooms, and it's okay to stand up and say that this isn't okay. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes there's also odd cases where a student, for instance, reached out to me because in an assignment they were transcribing material from an archive, and the student was concerned that that labor was going to be used by their professor in their research. And so I messaged the professor and said, I've received this concern. Is there anything that you would like to say and anything we could talk about here? And it turned out that it was completely unrelated to what she was studying, and it was really not an issue at all. But the student's concern was quite valid, but it just needed some clarification. And sometimes those conversations are hard to have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, how do students get a hold of you, and how do they find the resources you guys have available for them? Trish, you're representing undergrads for the
Yes, Student if Society? You're an undergrad and you need help, my email is studentadv.coord@sfss.ca, which is really annoying, and I'm working on changing it. but my website's probably easier to find. Go to sfss.ca, services, student advocacy, and all my contact info is there. You can book an appointment with me through that website. We can do it in person or remote or at a Starbucks or wherever. Pretty flexible that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and so my email address is advocacy@sfugradsociety.ca. So the last bit's all one word. We're on the second floor of the Maggie Benson building. Their GSS offices are there just a little bit past the bookstore. And my office is there. Again, reach out to me on email. We can similarly set up in person, virtual, whatever meetings. Vancouver campus if needed, Surrey campus if needed, all of that kind of stuff. So again, like I said, similar to Trish, like get in touch with us early. Sometimes, like, even if you're not thinking of doing anything and you just want to be like, hey, this thing's going on, I just want to talk to someone about it, totally okay to come and chat with us as well, right? Like, it sometimes is just helpful to, like, you know, throw ideas about what's going on with you to someone else that you want to talk about things confidentially with.
Great. Well, thank you for joining me here today, Trish Everett, Student Advocacy Coordinator for the Simon Fraser Student Society, and Harjot Gruhl, Advocate and Policy Advisor for the SFU Graduate Student Society. Thanks for coming. I think this is a really important topic and some great information you've been able to share today.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Great.
That was Trish Everett, Student Advocate for the Simon Fraser Student Society, and Harjot Gruhl, Advocacy Director for the Graduate Student Society at SFU, speaking to me recently on the issue of student complaints and dealing with the university in academic situations.
Curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
This is Bird Note, with a special April Fool's Day quiz for you. Only one of the birds we're about to hear is real. See if you can tell which one, and let us know at birdnote.org for a chance to win a prize. Here is our first bird. The gray go-away bird of southern Africa is smoky gray with a tall, wispy crest. Favoring open woodlands and thorn savanna, gray go-away birds are known for their loud and nasal calls, often alerting other birds that there's a photographer nearby. Here is our second bird. The green treasure snatcher of Ecuador is a large ground-dwelling bird with a scaly head that almost resembles a box turtle. They're known for snatching jewelry and other shiny objects from travelers and hoarding it in deep burrows. And finally, bird number three. The zombie crossbill of Eastern Europe is often observed plucking the brains out of grasshopper heads. Omega-3s and other fatty acids found in brains help zombie crossbills fuel up for their long journeys south each winter. Visit birdnote.org to let us know which bird you think is real and for your chance to win a prize. From BirdNote, happy April Fool's Day. I'm Nick Byard.
Tokyo. 날리 기울디 오라 미소디오 또 니투고 노나니 나파르트 이리마니 홍아투와 디토롱 아실리 여보 기세냐 유인나세아 로노 이익긴 기차르토 Daima, Rima, Tsinio, Nima. Asini, Rini, Nima, Pisutrina, Rama, Tasiunga, Domi, Voma, Lio, Tio. Nalini railini malitu nalini uva nima si tati turi maluti tur asiti mima uchagunai logo nalini atungiu tachayangi tavo iikit kitsalakto daima Rima, Tziniu, Nima. Olako nali yitzu iripinea nivu, songo yo akitimin no yatitzu lo, akona uta priyo. Yoto ni tugu nunani na parto iri mani hongatu va titoro hagunai logo nalini atungi uta hayangi tavo ikit kitsalato daima rima
Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
pigeon rap,
and anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.